Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Let's close the wall up with our English dead. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and good morning, everyone. Unless you're listening in Europe, and then it's good afternoon and evening, everyone. Unless you're listening in Hawaii, then it's good, really, really, really early morning. Time is malleable. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure, and hopefully I have Elder Baldy, Jeff McClure, on the other line. We are going to find out momentarily, and this, I'm going to demonstrate the technical difficulties of all things considered. Can we get a telephone on the radio?
Did it work?
I think it did.
All right. Can you hear me? Yeah, it's amazing. Technology worked.
Well,
doesn't happen every time.
So, is it time to take our clothes off?
Yes, let us disclose. No TH in there. There's just an S in there. We're disclosing. We're opening.
We're disclothing.
Disclothing.
The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, which you probably already figured out, but it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that's registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which doesn't imply that they approve or disapprove of us. Actually, they probably disapprove.
That's their job, disapproval, yes.
Yeah. And even though we're a registered investment advisory firm, we are not giving investment advice on this radio program. We're giving educational information, which is a different animal altogether. Investment advice is given based on individuals' specific needs and desires and risk tolerance and a lot of other stuff, which is one of those technical terms. Educational information applies to just about everybody and probably everybody. We do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid for this radio program. Instead, we do advertise for the radio program on the radio
station. Yes.
But we're not paid for the program. We don't pay for the program. And I guess that's the end of that. We do it as a public service.
Yeah.
Since a lot of our clients listen to it, we get some incidental benefits from it. But I still don't completely understand why we work on Saturday mornings and spend a lot of time preparing for this, other than the fact that we have done it for so long, and the inertia just keeps on pushing us forward.
You still don't complete. You're the one that started this thing. You don't understand what we're doing? Goodness gracious.
Well, if I ever get to where I think I know what we're doing and
we'll
why
change
we're
our
doing
minds.
It, yeah. I probably need to go do something else. We gather the information that we present on this radio program from sources we deem to, and this is my one opportunity during the week to use this word, deemed to be reliable.
You just are not deeming enough times to use the word deem. I deem that deem should be used all the time.
Well, I occasionally use a redeem.
Yeah.
But I only publicly use the word deem once a week, and it's on this disclosure. Our disclaimer. Let's see. We deem to be reliable. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what else are we supposed to do?
You're supposed to warranty or guarantee or not warranty.
Oh, yeah.
Or
we do not warranty or guarantee the information, the accuracy or completeness, because we get it from sources we deem to be reliable. See, I use it again.
Yeah. I just wanted to give you that extra opportunity to use a word you don't use enough, in my opinion.
And we can always say, nobody's perfect, information is never perfect, and the future is always uncertain. So if we say anything about the future, it's uncertain, and we don't warranty the future even coming. I won't even guarantee the sun will rise tomorrow morning.
I disagree.
Fact, probably won't.
Completely, the sun does not rise, the earth spins. I think
spins or turns.
That's up for debate. I think this whole concept about the sun rising is very anti-physics.
Misleading.
In every direction, because the sun does not rise. If you think about the gravitational pull of the Earth versus the sun, and we consider rising being to fight gravity on Earth, yes, it's very clear the sun does not rise in the morning.
Yeah, but it looks like it rises.
Yeah, well, that's good enough. For most people, this is one of my favorite questions to give to young teenage types that are interested in the big wide world around us and the physics of everything. And I ask them if they have ever seen the world turn. And to this point, I haven't had anyone in their initial answer say yes. Then I point out what happens when you see the sunrise. You're watching the world turn. And they all have these big-eyed looks of wonder on their face of, oh, it's right there. It's just so common that we see it and don't see it. I think there's a lot of that in the economy as well.
Yeah, there is. Speaking of the economy, we have one.
We do, yes.
And we monitor very carefully one aspect of the economy very, very intently, which is the stock market.
Yes.
So should we say anything about the stock market?
No, I think it's overrated. No, I do actually think we should. Sorry.
Okay. Well, for those of you who haven't read our newsletter or haven't kept up with this, the S&P 500 has been in the habit for the last 3 months or so of doing unusual things, things we've never seen before, just because I guess it got bored. It dropped a whole bunch, and it's come up a whole bunch, but this week, stock market rose 4.9, well, the S&P 500 rose 4.91% from last week. Now, we get to where we say it's nearly 5%. Let's round that off to 5%.
All right, that's generalized. Okay, that's fine. 5% up.
Okay, so we had a 5% rise in the market, and that's not even shocking now. But if you think about 5% rise in the market, if it did this every week for a year, that would be, I mean,
260%. Yeah, that's not going to be a thing.
All it has to do is 1 month of this, if you did 20 weeks of this, it would rise 100%.
Yeah, and we don't think that's going to happen. That's not reasonable.
But it rose 4.91%, and it rose 4.91% primarily because the Labor Department reported that unemployment in the United States, and by the way, this is a less than completely accurate report, but still it's their official report.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they call it a first estimate.
Yes.
We have unemployment in the United States of 13.5%. Now, had we had unemployment reported in January at 13.5% back when it was 3.5%, if the Labor Department came out and said at the end of January, unemployment is 13.5%, the market would have collapsed probably further than it did in March.
Yes.
But instead of collapsing, the S&P 500 went up 5% for the week. And it not only went up 5% for the week, at present it's only down 1.14% from the beginning of the year and only down 5.68% from its high in February. So another week like the one we had, and we would be right next to all-time record highs in the midst of what is arguably, at least predicted to be, the worst quarter for earnings and GDP since we've been measuring earnings and GDP.
Right.
And the market is almost back to where it was before anything went wrong.
So shall we explain the lunacy and how it's actually sanity? Or should we say that lunacy and sanity are irrelevant?
Lunacy has to do with the moon.
Yeah, well, there's a great story about that. The reason why we say lunatics, because there was a religious sect in old Rome, in the Roman Empire, as Christianity was taking over. And the Roman Emperor had said, hey, we're all Christian now, you got to stop doing your services to the moon every full moon on top of that hill over there, because we can see that hill, and if you go back over there, we're going to arrest you all and feed you to lions. And they still showed up on the hill and still worshiped the moon. So we still say lunatic, which was the term given to that religious sect, meaning crazy, because they all showed up anyway and continued to worship the moon. So there you go. Lunacy has a real root from ancient times.
Yep.
It's all very moonlight.
You want to explain why the market went up?
Over the last week? I will tell you that the reason why the market went up is because a lot of people were buying stocks.
Right. but only a relatively small number of stocks.
Right. So the majority of stocks did not rise with the market. In fact, went the other direction. And this is one of those areas that lets us see that it isn't lunacy. Now, the fact that the market as a whole is up to the level that it is, I don't know that that is completely reasonable, because a lot of people, and if it was completely reasonable, I'd be terrified, because humans generally are not reasonable. If suddenly they all started acting rational and logical, I would say, what is wrong? Who put something in the water? But we're seeing a small group of stocks being piled onto because they're rising by a lot of other people's money. It wouldn't surprise me to see some of those hiccup not very long into the future. It also wouldn't surprise me to see a lot of the stocks that have fallen begin during even this stock market rise begin to rise as the other ones fall, because the reality is that the economy is opening up again. This takes, you know, take the coronavirus thing to the side for a moment, and we can look at the economy as a whole. And the damage to the economy was caused by coronavirus, but specifically directly caused by us all trying to be extra careful and shutting down businesses. Well, now we're slowly opening those businesses back up, and it's very unlikely, even if we get a big, big, extreme spike in the virus here in the United States, that we do something that South Korea would do or China has done, which is shut everything back down again. I think that the politicians have experienced enough pain that they're not willing to do that again. We just spoke about that on the way here as I was talking to you on my Bluetooth on the way to the studio, that we don't think that there's enough fortitude in the politicians at this point, if we saw a big spike in the viral transmission, to crank it back down, to shut everything back down. So from an economic perspective, short term, we've been through the worst part of the virus. That's economic. We may not be through the worst part of the virus on the health end, but on the economic side, we've been through the worst part short term.
I want to take you back to something you said earlier.
Okay, go ahead.
The market jumped a whole bunch based on what previously would have been considered bad news.
Right, but as compared to the other bad news, it was good news.
Right. Yeah. But you said it was lunacy.
Yeah.
Lunacy occurs at the full moon. Do you know when the full moon occurred this month?
Yes, I do. As a matter of
fact. Friday.
Yeah. Just happens to coincide with the big, big jump in the market. Yeah.
Just happened to coincide with the big, big jump.
There was a lunar eclipse, too. There was a lunar eclipse happening.
Well, but not here, and it was very minor. It was called a strawberry eclipse.
Right.
On the other, and you'd have
because
to be on the other side of the planet.
Strawberry eclipses happen when the moon's shadow go over the strawberry patch. That makes sense. That's not true, by the way, just as a side note. I do not deem that to be accurate.
It was a very minor eclipse, so if you'd been on the other side of the planet where you could see it, because we couldn't see it because it was daylight when it occurred here. You would have noticed that the bottom half of the moon became very slightly pink. Now, you would have been able to see that if you're in a very dark environment. In other words, you weren't near a city.
Right.
So it's really not that much of an eclipse.
Now, all this talk about the market and about the economy, we've brought up the virus quite a few times already. We've left out a pretty important factor here. And that is that there is a massive movement across the country that was started based on whichever way we want to say this. It really doesn't matter how it comes out, either the perception of police brutality or the actuality of police brutality. And that is what's happening across the United States, and specifically how it affects African Americans, black people. And it doesn't really matter what anybody else believes about this. If a group of people believe that they're being subjugated, then they are. And I realize that that's a really, really simple statement, but it doesn't matter if we're talking about the old Soviet Union or China or a dictatorship in Northern Africa or in Syria. Syria is Northern Africa too, so I'm going to just double down on that. It doesn't matter. If there's a group of people that either believe they are subjugated or are without a doubt subjugated, that doesn't matter. If they believe they are, they are. And there is a tenet of economics that goes so deep on the behavior side. It is far better for any nation, to stop subjugating people. The whole concept of subjugating is to give less importance to that group of people or to treat them differently. And I'm going to throw out some quick statistics out there. I would highly recommend that you look them up yourself. There are a lot of people that talk about crime rates and race, and they talk about a lot of other things. But if we correct simply for one factor, and this is an economics program, so this is a pretty amazingly easy guess as to what the factor might be. Correct for socioeconomic status. If you look at people in the poorest areas, you're going to find something amazing. There's no difference in the racial statistics on crime as long as you correct for socioeconomic situation. This is amazing. I realize this is not groundbreaking stuff. This is stuff that we've all known since forever, that the poorest people commit the most crimes. So the idea in any good economic plan is, how do you bring up the poorest people? How do you get them to be, if we're talking about America being a consuming economy, how do we get them consuming more? That's how everybody benefits. They benefit, we benefit. This is the whole concept of capitalism. If anybody's ever heard of the invisible hand, this is what we're talking about. How do we raise up poor people so that they can buy our stuff? That's economics. And as long as there is an official, semi-official, or cultural reason to push down a group of people, then the whole economy suffers for it. And I can say this 100 times, it doesn't matter what country we're talking about. If there's a group of people that's subjugated, they are not going to be as successful as they could be. And that hurts everybody around them. It isn't like we can group of people together and make it harder for their lives to progress, and that will somehow make everybody else feel better. There's a human nature there that says maybe if they're feeling worse, then I'll feel better in comparison. But the reality is that freedom and the ability to pursue your own enlightenment, success, so long as it doesn't harm other people, is the basis of capitalism. And if we have an institutionalized cultural bias that's being talked about here, and just because we don't have the same perspective, we don't believe someone else's view, that's a problem. And that was a lot of economics talk. Let me break that down into pure layperson. If there's a group of people that have a hard time making a living through no fault of their own, how do we get that easier? And I'm not an advocate of artificially pumping up numbers at the university level and saying, based on race, get in here. I am an advocate for saying low socioeconomic. Let's find the smart people in there, because I happen to be related to one. You may not want to talk about this, but I think it's important. Elder Baldy came from the lowest of the low socioeconomic status. The people that he grew up with are still there. Elder Baldy, my dad. The reason that I have the success that I have is because he pulled himself out of that, brutally pulled himself out of it. And I know you wouldn't speak about this way on the air, but I think it's vital that people hear this. It's hard when you're the lowest in any social circumstance to start a business, to get a job. And if they can identify you by the way you look and associate you with that socioeconomic status, it's even harder. Part of the way Elder Baldy made it is he moved. And when he moved somewhere else, he didn't look different than the other people that were successful.
Actually,
go ahead.
Actually, I got out of it because I went in the Army.
Yeah.
I got a college education to begin with. And not so much that the education was that much good, but I had the piece of paper, and the piece of paper enabled me to get a commission in the Army, which put me into a separate class of people. And the Army kept moving me around. And, you know, I didn't look at all different from the other people in the Army. I wore the same clothes, had the same haircut. We all looked pretty much alike.
Now, why am I touching on this the way that I am? It's because many of us have been pretending for decades that everything's equal again. We had a black president, right? I voted for that guy, or I know people that voted for that guy, he's my president. It doesn't mean that we still don't carry around these biases. That's all behavioral economics is a compendium of biases. What makes us make decisions? Are they good decisions or bad decisions? And a bias doesn't have to be a bad thing. If you're walking through a bad area of town, and you see a group of young men approaching you, and they're wearing the clothes of the bad area of town, it's probably pretty smart to vacate the premises, because that's smart. Prejudice means that you prejudge. And if we prejudge on issues that are inappropriate, not inappropriate in a political sense, I mean inappropriate in an economic or physical danger sense, then it's a bad decision and it's a bad bias. It's a good bias to avoid young men in bad economic situations. I think anybody could say that throughout history. They wouldn't say it in the same language, but if you're in a bad part of town at night and you see a group of young men heading your way, you should probably leave. We have added another layer to that in saying that race has something to do with that. So that we've skipped out of saying in a bad area of town, and now we're starting to say if you're anywhere and you see someone that looks like this, starting to say, I think we've said it for a long time. A lot of us have pretended that it wasn't real. But the reality is that we still group a large number of people together based on the color of their skin. And it's not codified in law, but it's still in our decision-making process. And that's what we talk about on this program, decision-making process. How do you plan for a better future? And what you do is if you're starting a business, and any business owner will tell you this, you get quality people, and it doesn't matter their background. If you find somebody that's quality, you build them up. You gain loyalty from them, and you give them loyalty, and you succeed that way. And they may be the one that buys the company from you. If you're making a bad decision because it's based on something that has nothing to do with the individual and more to do with a big class statement about a group of people, that's where the bias comes in. And we look at this at the stock market all day long, every day. If you have a bias that prevents you from making good decisions, it's a bad bias. And racism as a whole is a horribly bad bias. Just for the success of your life and the lives of the people around you, if you can take that out of the equation, it's not a simple process. This is something people grew up with. And this is a demographic thing. And again, I recommend people looking this up. If you look back through the history of the United States at the prison populations, man, it sounds like I just did a massive change of subject. I did not. If you look at the prison population is generally about 80% made up of the last immigration wave, whatever that is. Right now you can see it, the transition took place, and the Latin American numbers in prisons are way, way up. Well, that was our last immigration wave. And all the way up through the early 2000s, from about the 1970s, it was a black population. And if you calculate in civil rights, the civil rights movement, as the immigration wave, then you could say this follows exactly the same pattern throughout history. You can go back into the late 1800s, into the early 1920s, and you'll find that 80% of the population of the prisons was Irish and Scottish people, or at least people that identified that way because their parents were from there. And you go back, you can see this throughout the history of our nation. The difference between those numbers and what's happening today is very, very simple. An immigrant wave generally doesn't stop at the front end. You have a kind of a lower wave of people coming in from that area of the world for about a generation. And that means that a large portion of them didn't suffer that immediate prejudice of no mix served. We don't serve the Irish. We don't serve black. So a lot of people coming in an immigration wave don't get to experience that. They get to experience the winning through feeling of I made it. They don't get to experience that front end wave of backlash against people that are there that don't have good jobs and they're dirty or stinky or whatever it is people call them at the time. They didn't get to experience that. When we're talking about African American and a different scenario, they didn't come in an immigration wave in the same way. They had a civil rights movement, which means that the vast majority of them have felt massive prejudice in their life, and that destimulates the economy. And you can look at numbers on this any way you want to look at it. It's bad for the long-term financial success of everybody. Why am I focusing on financial success? Because that's what we do. This is when we talk about. And when there's a racial bias that gets in the way of good financial decisions, it's just plainly stupid. And this isn't touching on the micro level. I'm just talking on the macro level. On the micro level, it's much more stark, much more disgusting, much more painful. On the macro level, it doesn't make sense from a leadership perspective unless you want to divide people. And the way you become a stronger nation economically, militarily, it doesn't matter, is to unite. Find an outside enemy, not an inside enemy. If you find an inside enemy, you have to take them out completely if you want to have a successful popular government. That's not any way of a solution here. We have Americans that request the rights of Americans. And those rights are based on economic prosperity. I mean, there's a lot of other slogans that were added to that, but the reality is that the founding fathers of our nation built our Constitution around economic prosperity. There was slavery included in that, because at the time that was economic prosperity. If we look at it today, slavery is obscene. We've got enough potential intelligence in any human individual to cause great success if they're provided the right environment. And I've put my money where my mouth is. I founded a preschool that accepts people from every background so that they can learn and be better than they were. And if we stop allowing people, or we make it harder for people to be better than they were, this is as basic an economic principle as you can get, it's harder for them to advance and be successful. So how do we loosen those constraints? I mean, I'm not saying we should be soft on crime. I think we should support our police. But we also need to look at the bad biases that come. And one of the amazing things that the police have to put up with throughout every day of their existence is they deal with the worst of humanity. That's what they're for. We call them when bad things are happening, and they come and they deal with the worst of humanity. It shouldn't surprise us when they're called out to deal with the rest of humanity that they use the same tactics. That means that we need a better way of educating. And amazingly, this isn't the first time it happened. There have been movements back and forth throughout our history where the police are given a great deal of leeway. They knock crime down, and we've seen that. And then we push too far and we keep giving them more and more and giving them more and more leeway. And bad actors in the police step up and do bad things. And then we flip back the other way and we say, all right, police shouldn't wear guns anymore. We're going to have them patrol the street and get to know the neighborhood. And if you doubt that, it's just really easy sets of example. Look at 1920s. What happened in the boroughs of New York? The Irish police were patrolling without guns, not because they didn't have them, but because it was a request, because there'd been too much police brutality against the Irish at the time. So Irish police officers were making friends with Irish people in the low socioeconomic area. We can do this. We've got textbooks for how to do it. We've done this before, just not with skin color. It's not that hard to make the leap. And if a large set of voices, the majority of voices from a group comes out and says that they're being subjugated, I'm going to apply the same standard that we apply against China or anywhere else in the world. They're being subjugated. That many people together don't lie. So let's listen. And that's my economics perspective on that. Why'd the market go up in the middle of that? I hope because when clusters of crises happen throughout history, we get permanent change. We get some beneficial change for forever. And I hope that's why the market's up right now. Because it's really hard to look at the front lines or front papers, front pages, headlines of any newspaper right now and not feel sick. All right, that was my soapbox. My feet are very clean, and I want to hand it back. I was soliloquying a little too much, I think.
Well, we're getting to the point where it's probably a good idea to play some commercials and then come back and switch subjects.
Yeah, sounds good. If you would like to talk to us, our phone line is all filled up with Elder Baldy, but if you would like to throw your opinion in here, the emails are available at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side
with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Wow, we actually were able to do the transition. One of these, after enough years of us being
of coronavirus,
I'll actually get good at this at some point.
I saw a cartoon that showed a guy, a couple of people who'd come in from the future. And they showed up and said, what year is this? We've just come from the future. And they said, oh, it's the spring of 2020. And they said, oh, the beginning of the isolation years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting. We have a question. It's from John. It says, seems like the response to COVID was to shut down the entire global economy. Mm-hmm. It appears this was the first time in modern history this has happened. As we open back up, are the fundamentals for investing short and long term going to change? No.
No.
But there's short term, fundamentals haven't changed. But what we're seeing in the market and a very good, healthy way of responding to this is there are some companies that are traded on the S&P 500, traded on the stock market, large, by definition, by definition, we look at them as large companies, even though they may be called small in terms of the stock market. But anyway, there's these publicly traded corporations. Some of them have seen their profits rise dramatically. They've seen their revenues rise, or they clearly could be reasonably expected to see their revenues rise dramatically on the other side. I mean, Walmart's revenues went up. Its profits didn't necessarily go up, but its revenues went up as it captured more of the online market and more of the grocery market. Zoom is probably the prime example. It was maybe going to make it kind of interesting technological innovation before coronavirus, and now it's just expanded dramatically to become, I'm going to Zoom you. You know, when something becomes a verb, when a product becomes a verb, it's going to do very well for a while at least. So there's a fundamental change in that. Everybody was doing okay, and it was kind of hard to tell who was going to do really well and who wasn't. I mean, there's some people who still thought Sears was going to do okay. But the big department stores have taken a huge hit. Macy's, Nordstrom's, all the ones that
Pier
we
one.
Think were invulnerable. Pier yeah. 1 going out of business. JCPenney going out of business, at least going into bankruptcy.
Right. There's still open stores at JCPenney. They're not experienced the full shutdown. They may have the ability to revive themselves, though I don't know how they're going to do it.
So what we're seeing is an acceleration in a technological change to a digital economy. Now, does that mean that everything's going to change? No. And it's, but for long-term investing, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. At least that's our opinion.
Yeah, we wouldn't have been saying invest in JCPenney a year ago. So, and we may have looked at Zoom and said they may have some potential. That's the direction we're going. They got a big spike of earnings, and a lot of people are making moves based on those spikes.
One of the things I don't think has changed that a lot of people do think has changed is the fact that right now the market is dominated by relatively few large growth stocks.
Right.
And value is in the pits. And it's been that way for several years now. So somebody, I'm starting to see the headlines says value over, is the time for value over with, is never again will buying something at a reasonable price make any sense. I don't think that's true.
Yeah. I see headlines like that. I've seen them enough times in my career to see that they usually start happening right before a big change in the way people value stocks.
And one of the things we're starting to see in the bond market, I think, is significant. We're starting to see interest rates rise towards
right.
the long end of the bond market and even in the middle of the bond market. And we say, and from our perspective, that's good because we've got a positive yield curve. The jump in the 10-year Treasury yield was like a 39.2% jump during the week, which is astonishing, the yield. It's trading at 0.9%, which we would have thought to be astonishingly low at the beginning of the year. But in fact, it's jumped tremendously from the 0.6% it was last week. Now, that sounds good for the future of the economy. The higher the interest rates go on the longer ends of the yield curve, the steeper the yield curve gets, and that's a forecast that there's a demand for borrowed money out into the future longer. So in other words, people are borrowing money over the long term, 10 years out, and they're doing that to do something. They're not doing it just for the fun of it. They're doing it to do something. People are trying to borrow money to build things, which is an indication that we have, which is why a positive yield curve suggests a good economy. But look at the backside of that. If you're one of those many, many people who bought bonds and forced the yield on the 10-year Treasury down to less than, way less than 0.5%, you have seen the value of your traded on the open market of your 10-year Treasury probably drop by about 20% in the last week. People don't talk about that very much. It's one of the things I've never understood when we talk about the bond market, they just talk about the interest rates. But as interest rates go up in the bond market, people who hold existing bonds see their values go down.
Now, if they hold to maturity and it's a good credit, or if you're talking about like the U.S. Treasury, they're going to get their money. If it's a good
right.
credit rated company, they should eventually get their money. If it's a bad credit rating and interest rates go up, then they're going to see a massive drop. The high interest rate that people see.
High yield.
They're often, that's their term. We call them junk. And that means that there's a much higher default risk. The risk that they will not be able to pay you back the loan that you gave them. Yeah, people don't talk about that side very much. Go ahead.
What I think we've seen, by the way, we've had about a 30-year bull market in bonds where interest rates have been falling for 30 years. And where the bottom was a matter of much debate over the last few years. But we now know, I think, with a great deal of certainty, where the bottom was. And the bottom was about a month ago when interest rates... when interest
was that was that COVID?
Bottom. No.
Are you sure?
That was liquid going down the wrong side of my throat.
Oh, okay. All right. Plumbing issue. Got it.
Yes. So the point is that some things are going to change. For example, as interest rates go up as we go into the future, and I think they will, I think they'll go up for a whole series of reasons, but the primary one is, I think, given going about a year or 2 years from now, we're going to see some rather dramatically increased economic activity, barring some horrific thing that we don't know about happening.
Which, sometimes horrific things that we don't know about happen.
But historically, if we follow history and we follow the cycles of history, the 2020s will probably be the equivalent of the roaring 20s in the last century. And the technological innovations that are popping up are going to start taking root, and this will be the inflection point. And at that point, there'll be a lot of demand to borrow money to buy new stuff, to buy new equipment, and industrialize and digitalize and
automate.
And that will cause interest rates to rise. And as interest rates rise, if you hold a big portfolio of bonds, and let's say you bought 20-year bonds, and 5 years from now or 10 years from now, you look at them and say, you know, this 1% I'm getting doesn't amount to a hill of beans. It's nothing. I'd like to sell my bonds, get my money back. You're going to be very sorely unhappy. I think this is no guarantee. We don't know the future. But I think you'll probably be very unhappy with what you could sell the bonds for. And if you pass them on to your heirs, and your heirs look at the value in there, because there's a double kicker here. If you die and you leave your estate to your heirs, it gets a step up in value, unless it's in some contractual form like an IRA. And when that happens, if you have big gains, and that's always the assumption when people talk about this, let's say you bought some stock for $1,000 and now it's worth $10,000 because you've held it for a long time. When you die, the tax basis jumps to $10,000, and if your heirs sell it immediately, they pay no taxes. Now, here's the interesting point. If you have some big losses built up in your portfolio, let's say you bought $10,000 worth of bonds and they're now worth $5,000. That's an extreme, but the last one I gave was extreme too. Let's say they were, you bought $10,000 worth of bond and they're now worth $6,000. When you die, that loss disappears too for tax purposes. So if your heirs sell them for $6,000, they don't get a tax write-off. One of the things we've been concerned about for a long time is interest rates crept down very low and very low and very low, that going out over the long term, longer dated bonds are going to be a bad idea to hold in a portfolio, and we've stayed away from them. But I think we were probably ahead of ourselves there. But I do think the bottom occurred. You mark it down in your calendar. The bottom in the bond market occurred.
Bottom of the interest rates.
Well, it's the bottom in interest rates, the top of the bond market, occurred about 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
There, as we go forward, bonds are going to be very unpopular to own. And it's going to take a while for this to happen, but as the stories start circulating around about people who lost a lot of money in bonds, people are going to be unhappy about bonds, and they'll turn away from bonds like they did back in the 70s.
I have clients that remember some decisions they made in the 70s, and it's part of what kind of sparked the interest in the current running bull market in bonds. At the end of the 70s, into the 80s, it was possible to get a government, a federal government, a U.S. Treasury bond that was paying 15 to 18% for 30 years. Just think about that for a second. And if you bought that in 1982 or 1981, 30 years is 2010. You've got a pretty good image in your mind about what the government pays and how safe bonds are. But that's only because interest rates came down during that time period that we look at that. Because when that bond was being issued, we had inflation that was higher than the interest rate, which meant it had to pay that just to keep up with the inflation. This was stagflation, for those of you that weren't around during the time. During Jimmy Carter's presidency, he wasn't responsible for it, but he certainly gets to wear the mantle of being president while it was happening. We had hyperinflation, massive inflation in high double digits, and it took some draconian moves by the Federal Reserve to cut that down. That started recessions. Multiple recessions were started by lowering interest rates or by raising interest rates by the Federal Reserve during that time period to get us out of hyperinflation. People didn't like bonds at the time, which meant less people would go and get a bond because they were or go and get a loan because they didn't want to get a loan for 18% for 30 years. So the market started drying up for the high interest. And coming forward, we have since that point, that extremely high interest rate, we've had consistently lowering over long-term trends interest rate. And that looks great for the bond market. Going forward, it's not a whole lot lower you can go with interest rates. Even if we go negative, that's going to be temporary. I don't think we're going to go negative in the United States, but
I hope not.
Even if we do, it's not assumed that this will be the way of life forever. Once people are more confident in a resurging economy, then they're going to want a higher return on their loan money. I mean, if people are loaning money out at extremely low rates for long periods of time, and a lot of that money's coming from individual investors. And if you've got a low interest rate for 30 years and you've locked it in, at some point you may double guess yourself. You may go the opposite direction, or your heir might. And that's a cause for interest rates to rise again. All that we're saying there is that interest rates have probably gotten close to as low as they're going to get. We had a call early this year about whether or not the interest rates would cross 4% or 3% first. And we said we didn't know, but that and it definitely hit 3%. Then that same caller came back and said, what about 2%? Which comes first, 2% or 3%? And we said, well, with the existing situation, more likely the 2%, but we don't know. And now it's, you know, what is the long-term, the 10-year rate that you were quoting earlier?
The 10-year is 0.902, is a little less than 1%.
Okay, which is higher than what it was at its bottom.
It's double what it was at its bottom.
And what that means is that we may see it go back down like that again. But it's relatively unlikely, just like it's relatively unlikely for us to shut down the economy again at this point. The politicians just don't have the stomach for it. And that's from my perspective. I'll hand that back to you. Jumped in there to agree with you, and then I started running off with the microphone.
Well, you know, there's a lot of indications that the markets are predicting a rise in the economy in the future. And I think it's probably going to happen. You may remember that crude oil, West Texas Intermediate, was down in negative territory a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's closed out this week. It actually doesn't close. It trades almost 24 hours a day. But at 5 o'clock Eastern time, it was at $38.97 a barrel, which is some of the shale oil producers can actually make a profit around $40.
Right. A lot of the Texas shale oil producers can make a profit at about $25. North Dakota's still having some issues.
So that's a 10% rise for the week. Now, one of the big questions in the market right now is this irrational exuberance or is it just exuberance? Well, it's exuberance. There's no doubt about it, because what we're seeing is probably the largest drop in corporate earnings in this quarter. We won't know until the end of the quarter and then the beginning of the next quarter. But what we're seeing indicates that we're probably have the largest drop in corporate earnings since we've been keeping close tabs on it. As a matter of fact, the drop in corporate earnings matches pretty much what we saw in 1930.
Just over a much, much shorter period of time.
Yeah. Everything we see about what's going on in this bear market and this recession is the most severe since we've been carefully measuring the numbers, which goes back to post-World War II time frame. And it also is going to look very much like it's going to be the shortest.
Right. The unemployment and the depression was worse, but it took place over a much longer period of time. We didn't have suddenly 1 month, everybody's out of work, go away. So there's differences. Go ahead.
One of the important things I want to say about, as we run out of time for this hour,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I want to say about the unemployment report and the reason that we had such an optimistic reaction to it, there's numbers down deep in the report that are important. Something like three-quarters of the unemployed people are saying they're not really unemployed.
They're furloughed.
They're furloughed. Now, whether or not they're going to get hired back, they think they're going to get hired back. And that is that means the unemployment rate could drop rather rapidly by 75%. We're still going to have, matter of fact, the forecast is around 10% unemployment by the end of the year, which is still pretty steep. But there's a lot of people who expect to be hired back, and as we're running out of time to talk about it. We can talk about it next hour.
Right. If you want to talk to us on the air, you can email us, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. If you want to talk to us off the air, there's
a local voicemail available at 254-947-1111. You can go toll-free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. There's voicemail there on the weekends and real-life people during the week. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a Contact Us form on there. You can read our newsletters that we put out a couple of times a week these days and recordings of our radio program going back quite a few years. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.